Welcome to the Shiur in Aksava Kabbalah, Parshas B'Shalach. I want to start off this Shiur with a Yishikoyach and a special shout-out, as they say nowadays, to Rabbi Chagi Rubin. Rabbi Chagi Rubin is the brother, of course, of our own Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Rubin. Maybe he'll be hearing this at some point. Rabbi Chagi Rubin is a Rav up in Connecticut and a Lower East Sider from way back when. And speaking to him in a different context on the phone yesterday, he said, "Oh, you're learning Aksava Kabbalah. You should definitely see the piece that he has on Kriyas Yamsuf." So, in that chus, I want to say over that particular piece, a fascinating, unique approach to Kriyas Yamsuf that the author of the Aksava Kabbalah has. And our thanks to Rabbi Rubin for pointing out the piece, and Be'ezus Hashem and his chus, we should make it through the Yamsuf together. Okay, so in Perek Yudalid Pasuk Chaf, so the Ksava Kabbalah writes as follows: B'chol makom yishamish al aholeich bayom loshen yirida kemo yardei hayom ba'onios v'chadome. Writes the author of the Ksava Kabbalah, typically speaking, when the Hebrew language wants to convey somebody going on the sea, the term, the verb which is used is yirido, descending into the sea. He quotes a famous line from Tehillim Kuf Zayin, Yardei hayom ba'onios, describing sailors who go on the sea in boats, they are yardei hayom, they go down to the sea. V'hoyel olomar gamkan loshen vayerdu v'lo vayovo. Right here, when it describes Klal Yisrael going into the sea, It says vayovo'u b'soch hayom, right? They came into the midst of the sea, right? Why shouldn't it use the lashon of vayerdu? They descended into the sea, as opposed to they came into the sea. So writes in response to that, there are other ways you could answer that kasha. I mean, after all, in the case of Kriyas Yamsuf, they actually weren't going into the sea, right? They were going to dry land. Right, what's that?
They had no boats.
Right. Maybe you read the bayom only means going onto the sea with a boat. You know, again, the ways you can answer the kasha. But he says as follows: Lo hoya b'kias yamsuf al derech hamafursam. Right, the splitting of the Red Sea was not the way we imagine it typically. Ki im hifli Hashem la'asos. Hashem made the following miracle. Shatahom shehu karkois hayom shamayim shochvim olav. The sea floor, which of course is considerably under the surface of the water itself, higbia Hashem oso me'at me'at mimekoma. The way Kriyas Yamsuf works, says the Ksava Kabbalah, is that God picked up the floor of the sea and very gradually raised the floor of the sea itself until it came up to what we would normally consider to be the surface of the water. V'nisa l'malo adshaniya b'mishva echad im sfas hayom. The floor of the sea was elevated until it was level with the shore itself. That's not normally what we picture. I think even in the movie they didn't do it that way, right? Certainly not what we picture, that the floor of the Yamsuf came up, but we're going to see in a moment what's his basis for making such a statement. So he says as follows, again continuing, V'chelek min hatahom sheba l'malo, that part of the sea floor that was elevated to be parallel to the shore, Nasa grid v'yovesh, that the sea floor dried out. Again, that was all part of the miracle. V'hu hoya derech slula v'tov la'avor alav. And now this dried out surface was now something that Klal Yisrael were able to walk on. V'hinei v'hinosei atahom l'malo v'niya derech slula b'li amokim u'gevoim. Now, naturally, as the sea floor rose to the top, and it became a place upon which the Jews were able to walk, hutzrichu me'ayom lihi bokeya v'lachatzos. Almost as a natural result of that, the water had to split as the sea was rising up, as the sea floor rather was rising up. In a sense, the seafloor rising up displaced the water as it rose to the top. Right? Now, as the floor rose up, this new area of dry land, it pushed to the side the waters themselves. Is that in Yentivi? That happened, all, you know, in a sense, the splitting of the sea was just the aftermath of the seafloor rising. The seafloor rose. That was really the miracle. And remember, the waters were pushed aside. But, of course, there's still more. Omnam ilu hayo nigarim kedar kamachafi tiveyem Yerutzel she'eris hayom yaminu smol haderach shenis chadesh v'cheilis nemu lachor el svas hayom. Nonetheless, there was still a need for an additional miracle because, okay, good. So the seafloor rose up and in doing so displaced temporarily the waters to either side. But once the seafloor was firmly established as being, you know, at its new elevated height on a parallel surface to the shore itself, so the waters should have come rushing back in to cover this new surface. Okay, you still would have had a sea, just a much more shallow sea, you know. Again, I guess if it was that high up, the Jews could have walked, you know, through the waters of the newly elevated Yam Suf. Just, I guess, the water would now come up to their ankles or their knees or whatever it was, right? Now, now that the surface was elevated, but God made an additional miracle. Al kein hifli Hashem yisparach laso shamayim shenigbu al yidei atahom shetzafu lemala. God made it such that the waters, which had been elevated by the seafloor moving up and now were floating and had been displaced and pushed aside, lo nasu lifnimu lachar v'lo l'she'eris hayom kedarkam, the waters which had been displaced and pushed aside did not come rushing back in to cover once again this new surface. Ela nechatsu l'shtayim, they were rather split into two pieces. And they were left as freestanding mounds of water on either side of this new path. It's interesting to note, we know midrashically, the Medrash describes how there were 12 paths for which the various shvatim went. For whatever reason, the Aksava Kabbalah does not seem to be working with that Medrash. He just describes what I think is, you know, perhaps, you know, the simpler way of understanding Kriyas Yamsuf, that the water basically split into two parts. You know, there was one two walls of water on either side of the path that was in the middle. So he seems to assume that it was just like that. The water was displaced. Again, it fits with his explanation of how Kriyas Yamsuf works. The water was displaced, and God miraculously kept the displaced waters in their place, so that they would not come rushing back down to cover over this new surface. V'hayaz, how did the water stand in these places? So that's what he says. V'hayaz there al yidei ruach kodim shaholich Hashem bayom kol halayla. The waters miraculously stood in their place through the special wind that God caused to blow through the sea the entire night. Now here, of course, we know the Aksava Kabbalah is referencing a pasuk that appears in the Sedra that describes how God made a wind blow through the Yam Suf through the course of the entire night. Right. Well, one second. Right, in Perek Yudalid, Pasuk Chof Aleph, Ayet Moshe Yado Al Hayom, before the Kriyas Yam Suf, Moshe spread out his hand over the sea. Vayolech Hashem Es Hayom Beruach Kodim Azor Kol Alayla. God caused there to be a strong eastern wind that came and made the sea move the entire night. Vayosem Es Hayom L'Charava. He caused the water to become dry land, vayibaku hamoyim, and the waters split. Right? Now, normally, we have different interpretations as to what the role of this wind was. This actually is an interesting Ramban. The Ramban writes, the role of the wind was to give people a way of explaining Kriyas Yamsuf in a naturalistic fashion. So in other words, the skeptic would always have room to say, it wasn't a miracle. Right? It was just, the wind was blowing at just the right time that it worked for the, you know, it worked that well for the Jews and badly for the Egyptians. Again, as improbable as that is, right? You know, what are the chances? But the Ramban writes, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to have this strong wind blowing the whole night so that the skeptic would always have a way out. You know, God never wants, even when making a miracle like Kriyas Yamsuf, God always wants to maintain our Bechira Chavshis, our free will, so that, you know, the skeptic should have a way of explaining away the events, you know, that if he wants to, he can choose not to believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the Ramban. But the Haksav HaKabbalah is giving a totally different explanation. He's saying the role of the wind was to help perform the secondary miracle of Kriyas Yamsuf. The primary miracle of Kriyas Yamsuf is that the surface of the dry land rose up, right? That was the major miracle. But once the water was displaced, God kept the waters in place via this wind that was blowing the entire night. And again, obviously a normal wind wouldn't do this, but a supernatural type of wind would have the ability to keep these waters at bay for the entirety of the night.
Last week we learned that Moshe specifically didn't say the night because he didn't want to be skeptical.
Right. Right. It's interesting. Yeah, so I don't know how you reconcile that Ramban with that Rashi, right? It's Rashi, you know, Kachatzos Salayla, Bachatzos Salayla. It's an interesting idea from the Ramban. In other words, again, you could definitely hear how somebody could look at it differently, but again, I'll that's what the Ramban says over here. It's interesting in terms of the Haksava Kabbalah that I think, in terms of his explanation of the wind, you have to work a little bit to work it into the Pasuk, because again, if the Pasuk we just read, so it says that God caused the wind to blow the whole night, the sea became dry, which again, what, according to the Haksava Kabbalah, that means the waters didn't come crashing back down because of the wind, so the floor of the sea remained dry. But then the last two words in the Pasuk, I think, are a little bit hard, according to the Haksava Kabbalah. The last two words of the Pasuk then say, Vayibaku hamoyim, the waters split. Now, according to the Haksava Kabbalah, the waters split before the wind. Right? In other words, the sea floor came up, the waters split as a result, and then God sent this wind to keep the water at bay, you know, to prevent it from coming back and overrunning the land, which had just, you know, naturally, or supernaturally, I should say, you know, come up and, you know, risen to this higher, to this higher level. So, again, I think you have to work a little bit on that Lashon Vayibaku Amoy.
You need two winds to do that.
What's that?
You need two winds to do that.
I guess, okay, but I guess that's, you know, the whole Pasuk is saying, you know, the wind, generally speaking, you know, a current over here and a current over there, you know, were what kept the water at bay. Right? Okay, maybe the way Aksava Kabbalah would explain is that, you know, God started the wind blowing first, so that when the water did split, it would stay in place. But again, you have to work through the Pasuk a little bit, according to the Aksava Kabbalah. Al Kopanim, in any case, he says, "Haruach haniflo hazeh chotza es hamayim hanigbohim ve'amidon lishnei tzidei haderach kishnei chovos." Oh, so actually, to Artie's point from before, he says the water rose up, and the wind basically bisected the water and split it into two pieces. So that's how he's explaining. How it actually split. The waters were displaced, and then God sent this wind through to formally take this water and put it into two sections. So that's Vayibaku Hamayim. You know, the water, which had just been sort of in a different place altogether, was now formally split into two parts because of the wind that was going through. Gam amdu amatzavon kol alayla, and the water, these walls of water stood that way the entire night. The afal pishu miderech hamayim lios nozlim, despite the fact that normally water tends to be liquid, that's the way water tends to be, right? And to just, you know, kind of you know, be spilling and pouring all over the place. Kamu amdu kamo neid, right? The water stood like a wall. Al yedei ruach azda, through this incredibly powerful wind. Hayotzei mikol zeh. What emerges from all of this is the following: sheikar anes haya brias haderech hachadosh shegavah hatahom lemalo. The major miracle was the creation of this new path, that the waters, that the sea floor rose up. Lo bikia samayim. It's not even so much that the waters split. That wasn't the major aspect of things over here. Ki bechehechrech hukruchu amayim lehiboka. The waters split just as a result of the sea floor rising up. So in other words, we talk about what happened at Kriyas Yamsuf. It's the sea floor rising up, which was really, in a sense, the primary miracle. The water splitting was a natural result of that. V'lochein nichtava habekia b'loshon nif'al sh'nivku'u me'aleihem. So, again, all of this is very nice. What are your proofs from the Chumash itself that this is the way it happened? So, a couple of things. So, first of all, says the Aksav HaKabbalah, this answers the question why the splitting of the sea is always referred to passively in the Chumash, right? Vayibaku'u hamayim. The waters were split, right? You know the passive voice is always used. Why use the passive voice? God split the water, right? Shouldn't it be expressed in a more active way? Hashem baka es hayom. Why should it be nivku'u amayim? You know, that the waters were split. It's always referred to in a passive sense. So he wants to say, the passive voice, which is used by Chumash in describing the splitting of the sea, recognizes the fact that, you know, what God did, so to speak, proactively, was to raise the sea floor, and the water splitting was a passive result of that action. So that's point number one in terms of, you know, where do we see this idea hinted at in the psukim themselves. Fact, yeah?
Once this land rose, why is there a problem with the water having to be split? It's split because of the walls of the new road. Once you have walls here, does that automatically split the water?
Right, no, so, but in other words, the water was displaced. But good, so now you have a new surface, so the water will come crashing back down and fill up the new surface.
Was the new surface above the new level of the water?
No, the new surface was now parallel to the shore. But there was so much water. That's how he presents it. There was so much water, so the water was shot up as the land began to rise, and it was split on either side. But again, once the land finds its equilibrium and just stops, you know, the elevator stops, so to speak, so the water is going to come crashing back down. So that's where the wind comes in. The wind comes into the middle and, you know, keeps the two walls of of water at bay, so they don't come crashing down again. Right, but apparently it wasn't. In other words, because there was so much water, right? If you think about it, I mean, in other words, you know, there was so much water between where the seafloor had been and where the seafloor was now, so, you know, all of that water was just pushed up on either side of the new seafloor, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, miraculously kept, you know, the walls in place. This, he says, explains. So the first, you know, place where we see this in the Psukim is this idea of you know, Vayibaka'u Hamayim, again, that the waters were split in the passive voice. Then he says an interesting pshat in a pasuk. We say this pasuk every day in the Shiras Hayom, and he gives a fascinating interpretation of it. Right? It says, the pasuk says in Shiras Hayom, Kafu'u tahomos belev yom. The tahom, the deep, was kafa in the midst of the sea. Now, the standard translation of kafa is they froze. To this day, if you go to Israel and you order something which is frozen, it's kafui, right? So kafu sahomos belev yom, the way it's normally understood is that the waters of the deep froze right? And those, the wall of water froze in place in the midst of the sea. So he wants to say an unusual interpretation of that phrase. He says, Kofu means they floated. Not they froze, but they floated. Where do we see that the word Kofu can mean floated? So he quotes a first apostle in Tzfanya. There is this book called Tzfanya. It's in Tanakh, right? So he talks in Tzfanya. It talks about kofim al shmarehem, right? Things that float on top of their dregs. And he also quotes the pasuk in Melachim, where it describes how Elisha Anavi made an axe float on the top of the water. So the pasuk there says Vayitzaf habarzel. Vayitzaf clearly means it floated. You know, the axe floated. And the targum over there says the kofa parzela. So in other words, the targum of Vayitzaf, it floated, is the kofa, that same shoresh, that same root of the kofu sahomos belev yom. Right? So he wants to suggest that that's what's going on over here. So kofu sahomos belev yom, the deep floated up belev yom. Belev yom literally in the heart of the ocean. What's the heart of the ocean? So again, if you were to ask me, I would say belev yom means way out in the middle of the ocean, you know, sort of away from the shore. That's the heart. The heart is the middle of something, right? So generally speaking, I would say if, you know, the shore is here and here, and, you know, smack in the middle, that's the Lev Hayom. So he gives a different interpretation. We find in Mishlei, Perek Lamed, Dorach Aniya Belev Yom. The ship goes out into the Lev Yom, into the heart of the sea. So Asak Sava Kabbalah, where in the sea does the ship float? On the surface. So the Lev Yom, he says, is the surface of the sea. So now, in light of all of that, let's go back to the pasuk. Kofu sahomos belev yom. The deep floated up to the surface of the sea. Now again, you know, you could argue on every aspect of that interpretation, but it's a very novel interpretation. And if you accept it, so then that is a source within the Shiras Hayom, which we say every day, for this very, very novel idea of the sea floor floating up to the top. Kofu sahomos belev yom. The tahom, the bottom, the sea floor floated up to the lev yom, to the surface of the sea. And that's essentially how the whole miracle of Kriyas Yamsuf took place. Right, so the smach l'dvarim ha'ele mibraisa de avos de Rebbe Nosson. He quotes the avos de Rebbe Nosson, which is one of the so-called mesechtos ketanos, the small mesechtos that are printed in the Gemaras, typically at the end of mesechta avodah zarah, at the end of Horius, where avos de Rebbe Nosson, which is sort of a running commentary on Pirkei Avos, writes. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, this is in the end of Perek Lamed Gimel and Avos to Reb Nosson. Rabbi Eliezer says, "Kofo lahem milamala, Hakadosh Baruch Hu brought up something from the bottom, for Avru Bo Yisrael, and the Jews passed over that thing from the bottom that God brought up, Kedei Shelo Yitzta'aru, so that the Jews should not suffer, you know, in going through the Yamsuf." So what does it mean that he took something from the bottom and brought it up to the top? So says Laksava Kabbalah, this is a source, you know, in Chazal for my reading of what's going on with Kriyas Yamsuf, that there's some movement from the bottom of the sea to the top of the sea, and that makes life easier for Klal Yisrael, because again, if you think about it, right, the sea had a certain amount of depth. So let's say God had cleared away all of the water in the Yamsuf and there was only dry land left. Okay, but still the Jews would have to go down into the sea floor And that itself would be a little bit of a trial and a travail. In other words, they'd have to go down and then go across, then climb back up again. This way, the very seafloor itself rose up to the top. Again, he argues in his reading of Alas the Reb Nosson, that was done, Kadesh Lo Yitztaru, that Klal Yisrael shouldn't even have that bit of discomfort in having to go down and then go up again in traversing the Yam Suf. Definitely very original. A very unique way of looking at it. Be'ezus Hashem, when we pick up after Ma'ariv, we'll move on from Kriyas Yam Suf. We'll talk about a mahalach he has, an approach he has to understanding certain psukim with regard to the war fought with the battle fought with Amalek at the end of the Sedra. So we'll do that Be'ezus Hashem after Ma'ariv. Okay, Rabbi Chanan ben Akiva. Welcome to the second half of the Shir Ksav HaKabbalah Parshas B'Shalach. So we know at the very end of the Sedra describes the Milchama, the war with Amalek, and the Sedra famously describes how the success or failure of the war was dependent on Moshe Rabbeinu lifting up his hands. Right? Vayokasha Yari Moshe Yodo V'Gavar Yisrael V'Chasha Yoniach Yodo V'Gavar Amalek. He picks up his hands, the Jews are victorious. He drops his hands, so the Amalekim are winning. So in Perek Yud Zayin Pasuk Yud Aleph, the Ksav HaKabbalah quotes the famous Mishnah on Rosh Hashanah. The Rabbi Seinu Lo Hayo Yadav Shamosha Nosfos Chamulchama El Kozman Shiyisrael Mistaklin Klapei Malo B'Shabdin Asliba Laviyam Shabashramayim Hayo Miskabrim Vim Lo Hayo Noflim. Chazal famously asked, what? So Moshe Rabbeinu had this magic in his hands. Chiyalav Shemosha, Osos Melchama, Shovros Melchama. They make it or break it. Literally, that's the lashon of Chazal. They make it or break it. You know, maybe that's where the expression comes from. I don't know. Osos or Shovros. So no. Rather, when Moshe Rabbeinu picks up his hands, so the people look up at his hands, and they're inspired to turn their hearts and their prayers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And conversely, when he drops his hands, so they no longer are turning their hearts and their prayers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So v'haysa imken aramas yadav shamosha harol v'neisos yistaklu klapei malo yishavdu libam lashamayim. Right? So it turns out that the whole point of the hands is to encourage Klal Yisrael looking up towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu. V'lazer hayomen ha'givah k'desh yuchlu l'roso kol Yisrael. That's why he stood there on the mountain that all the Jewish people should see him. The kashero yaharamas yado kamehemo yisaklu v'kivnu libam v'chlochen kashereiach yado. When he lifted up his hands, that's when the people turned their hearts towards Hashem, as opposed to when he dropped his hands. Pirkei d'Rebbe Elezer, and the Medrash Pirkei d'Rebbe Elezer, it elaborates on this. Amru ro es Moshe kare al birka v'im karem al birkeiyim nofel upon of arso v'im nofel upon of arso. The Pirkei d'Rebbe Elezer takes this one step further. It wasn't just that he lifted up his hands, but Moshe Rabbeinu was mamish davening. He fell on his knees. When he fell on his knees, the people fell on their knees. How this worked in the midst of a battle, I'm not sure. You know, usually if you're in the midst of a battle, falling on your knees is probably not the best strategy, but I guess it means those who weren't actively engaged in the battle at that time, Moshe Rabbeinu would fall on his face, he would fall tachanun. And the people, you know, again, who were not mamish fighting the Amalekim at that point, would fall on their faces. So really, he was davening not just with his hands; he was davening, according to the Pirkei d'Rebbe Elezer, with his whole body. And the people followed suit. With Targum Yonatan ben Uziel, and the Targum Yonatan ben Uziel again expresses this idea that Moshe Rabbeinu was not just, you know, like a referee, up with the hands, down with the hands, but really was engaged in a very significant way in davening. When Moshe Rabbeinu raised his hands in prayer, and when he would put his hands down from praying, that's when the Jewish people were not victorious. Okay, so Moshe Rabbeinu was busy praying. So here comes the clincher. In light of the fact that Chazal tell us that the lifting of Moshe's hands is really just a way of him praying and signaling Klal Yisrael that they should pray, so then why does the Torah speak about Moshe Rabbeinu lifting his hands and lowering his hands? you know, the Torah should speak about when Moshe Rabbeinu prayed and when Moshe Rabbeinu stopped praying. In other words, if they, once we define that the lifting of the hands and the lowering of the hands is really Moshe Rabbeinu davening, you know, or, you know, davening more intensely, stopping to daven, whatever it is, shouldn't that then be the focus of the pasuk? Why is the pasuk focusing on just the raising of the hands? It's like, you know, you talk about a guy who's davening with kavanah, he was shuckling, he wasn't shuckling. Okay, the point isn't that he's shuckling, the point is that he's davening.
I think we should ask also, why would Moshe stop that?
Right, so it's interesting. Why would, if it's all about Moshe Rabbeinu davening, so wasn't he davening constantly? So I guess the answer is that you see that even somebody on the madrega of Moshe Rabbeinu has to take breaks in the middle of intense davening. Meaning, davening doesn't just mean mumbling the words. Davening means really connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and if you do that seriously, just like again Lahavdil, with a physical exercise, you have to stop and pause and catch your breath and you know, have a drink of water, whatever it is. With real intense davening, there are times where you just have to catch your breath, you know. And Moshe Rabbeinu, even somebody on the madrega of Moshe Rabbeinu, there were times where he just had to pause in the middle of his tefillah. And as necessary as those pauses were, they impacted negatively on the battle. That's what emerges from, you know, all of these makoros. It's a fascinating idea, right? Even a Moshe Rabbeinu can't just, like, you know, he's not a davening machine, you know? You have to, you know, you can't overwork the motor, otherwise it's just not going to function as well.
If we're saying that davening could be equivalent of lifting his hands, and when he lowered his hand, that means he stopped davening, and then things turned wrong.
Right.
So that means the minute Moshe Rabbeinu stopped davening, it went to hell.
Okay, yeah, so to speak, yeah.
So
that's Yaakov's question. So why did he stop davening? I mean, just keep doing it. And l'chora, the answer is, he had no choice. Meaning, if he would have just davened straight, he would have, like the motor, he would have burned out. You know, the times with any piece of machinery, if you overwork it, you destroy it. So, right, so even Moshe Rabbeinu, right, as great a person as he was, again, I don't think we fully understand what the nature, the lofty nature of his tefillah was, but, you know, he would have overheated and been unable to daven at all had he not paused for breath, you know, during the course of this davening. Again, it's a fascinating idea. I wouldn't have said that intuitively, but that's the idea which seems to emerge from all of these makoros. If raising and lifting, you know, raising and lowering the hands is synonymous with davening, it means that Moshe Rabbeinu at certain points stopped davening. And presumably he only did so because he had to, because otherwise, you know, why on earth would Moshe Rabbeinu stop davening, you know, especially because he saw it was so effective right in the middle of this milchama.
Also, we don't know how long it lasted. I mean, if it lasted only 15, 20 minutes, he could have gone, you know, from beginning to end.
Right.
But if it lasted a couple of hours.
Right.
Why do you choose this term, this hollow?
So that's exactly the question of Aksava Kabbalah. In other words, in light of the fact that raising and lowering the hands is really, you know, really all about his davening and not davening, right? So why don't you just say Vayol Kasher Hispalel Moshe V'Gavar Yisrael V'Kasher Hisrit Mila Hispalel Kasher Hiniach Mila Hispalel Gavar Amalek. Why are you focusing on the hands? Again, like we said before, so, you know, if a guy's davening very hard, you don't talk about his shuckling. You know, the shuckling is secondary. It's the davening which is really the main thing.
On
the physical hands, right. Right. So maybe, you know, it's interesting, what's the role of Aaron and Hur? Maybe by providing him some physical relief, they enabled him to focus more and to be able to daven without having to take those breaks. You know, in other words, the physical and the spiritual were connected in this regard. But it's interesting, right? And it's an interesting question.
Right.
So they gave him the koach, which then enabled him to daven in turn. Right. It wasn't just they gave him the koach to keep his hands in the air. They gave him the koach to keep davening. But again, why not mention the davening? So he gives the following fascinating answer. Ki be'emes b'milas yodo nichlo lo gam kein hatfilo. You should know the word yad, which of course means a hand or an arm, is also a word that means tefillah, which means davening. Kishorish yad hora also gam kein hatodo v'ashevach v'ahilu. The very word yad means giving thanks and praise. Kemo yichtov yodo l'ashem. So for instance, you have a pasuk in Yeshaya, Perek Mem Dalet, that a person who is pledging allegiance to HaKadosh Baruch Hu will write his hand to Hashem. Yichtov yodo l'ashem. What does that mean? Right? So, you know, he gives God a handshake or something. What does that mean? So he understands yad means that he will pledge praise to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He will give thanks to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the metaphor for praise and thanks is the hand. Other examples. Kush toritz yodav le'elokim. By the pasuk in Tehillim Perek Samaches, the land of Kush, of Ethiopia, it will run its hands to Hashem. Now again, what does it mean, it will run its hands to Hashem? So he understands it to mean Kush will give its thanks to Hashem, will give praise to Hashem, but the way in which thanks or praise are represented is the idea of the Yad. Umizev in Osati Lohem Beveisi V'chom Osai Yod Vashem. A pasuk that is famous today because of an institution in Yerushalayim, Yod Vashem, right? But, you know, it's well known to us from the Haftarah, which we lay in on Tanesim, on fast days, right? Those people who feel excluded from the house of Hashem for whatever reason, says Hashem, I will give them in my house Yod Vashem. I will give them a hand and a name. What does that mean over there in that context? So he says, the word Yod in that context also means a source of thanksgiving and praise. Milas Yod ugam kein inyam hilul v'shevach ukvoshir b'shar mekomus b'chubar shtei milas elul tehila u'l'shem. Right? You know, if these people are given something, they will be given the opportunity to praise Hashem. They will have the Yod v'shem. They will have an opportunity to give thanks and praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu for that which they have experienced. Vehora also gamken meinin as lehachna la'avodas hatfila. Right? Yad also carries the connotation of submitting to Hashem in prayer. Kimavuar, right? As we've explained. And he says that's also the pshat earlier in our schedule. V'nei Yisrael yotzim biyod rama. The Jewish people are going out of Egypt with a yad rama, with an up, a raised arm, right? And earlier in the sedra, in Perek Yudal of Pasuk Ches, on that pasuk, raised or yotzim biyad rama, he writes that the word biyad is related to the word betoda. You know, yad and toda carry a similar shoresh, right? It's a yad is the expression of thanksgiving. So the way to understand Biyad Rama is that Klal Yisrael went out with a sense of gratitude to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for having left Egypt. So in other words, the term Yod, you know, the hand, is always an expression of the idea of gratitude, of thanks, of submission, of prayer before HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Mimela, you know, it's not that the pasuk over here just speaks about Moshe Rabbeinu raising and lowering his physical hands, right? The very word yad itself implies praise and thanksgiving and prayer. So to speak of Moshe Rabbeinu raising his hands is to speak of him praying, is to speak of him giving thanks to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of his praising HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of his beseeching HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? It's not just a physical description, but, you know, it's a metaphor. Moshe Rabbeinu raising his hands is essentially a metaphor, which means offering thanks, offering praise, offering prayer, you know, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And it's not that, you know, that that's you know, something secondary to what the Torah is describing. That is what the Torah is describing by speaking about the raising and the lowering of his hands.
That's the case, you don't need the Mishnah.
Right, so the only thing the Mishnah is adding is that the Mishnah is essentially bringing out this idea. In other words, by the time of the Mishnah, people may not have understood the metaphor of the Chumash. In other words, people saw the Chumash is just talking about his physically raising and lowering his hands. Oh, so what good is that? What does that have to do with anything? So essentially, the Mishnah explains, you know, what the function of raising and lowering the hands was. But, you know, I think what Daksava Kabbalah is saying is that if we really understood Chumash properly, we would have understood that which the Mishnah is Mechadesh just by virtue of, you know, understanding the metaphors, you know, which are used in the Chumash itself. Okay, I just on a housekeeping note, I just want to know, Be'ez Hashem, next week we'll be having the Shir Monday night. I think it happens to work out well. It's a legal holiday, so probably, you know, more people have the opportunity to come to the Shir. I happen to be away next week, Tuesday and Wednesday, so it's hard to say the Shir Wednesday night when you're not here on Wednesday. So Be'ez Hashem, we'll have the Shir Monday night for Parshas Yisro. Again, also, you know, following Mincha and following Ma'ariv, and we look forward to seeing everybody then. I wish everyone a good Shabbos.